It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday ahead of us for the next hour, and with us to provide analysis, Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
And Jim McCormick, joining us by phone, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim, great to have you back as well.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
A little later in the program, we're going to focus, of course, centrally on the 2016 presidential race. There was a GOP forum in New Hampshire on Monday, and, of course, a little preview of the first GOP debate slated for tomorrow. Also, we'll talk about the Planned Parenthood controversy, and we heard in the top of the hour's news the President Obama's campaign to sell the Iranian nuclear deal to Congress. But first, we want to talk about the president's clean energy plan and reaction to it here in the U.S. and abroad. Also, about where some of the 2016 field stand on the issue of climate change. Join our conversation. Where do you stand on Obama's clean power plan? It's been reported over the last couple of days. And how much will a candidate's position on climate change influence which candidate gets your support? Support in the Iowa caucuses. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet Iowa Public Radio at IPR Talk. President Obama has unveiled what he has called the biggest and most important step we've ever taken in tackling climate change, the aim of the revised Clean Power Plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions from U.S. power stations by nearly a third within 15 years. The measures will replace place some significant emphasis on renewable energy sources, wind, Iowa, a great leader there, solar power, and other renewable energy sources. However, opponents in the energy industry are vowing to fight the plan. They say the president has declared a war on coal. Reminder that power plants fired by coal provide more than a third of our country's electricity supply. Here's some of what President Obama had to say in making his announcement about the Clean Power Plan.
Levels of carbon dioxide, which heats up our atmosphere, are higher than they've been in 800,000 years. 2014 was the planet's warmest year on record, and we've been setting a lot of records in terms of warmest years over the last decade. 1 year doesn't make a trend, but 14 of the 15 warmest years on record have fallen within the first 15 years of this century. Climate change is no longer just about the future that we're predicting for our children or our grandchildren. It's about the reality that we're living with every day, right now. As one of America's governors has said, we're the first generation to feel the impact of climate change, and the last generation that can do something about it. And that's why I committed the United States to leading the world on this challenge, because I believe there is such a thing as being too late.
Okay, President Obama speaking about his clean power plan 6+ years into his presidency. Jim McCormick, why is this being launched now?
Well, I think it's really tied to what he said back in 2007 and 2008, that dealing with climate change was going to be one of his priorities. But given the other kinds of issues that he's had to deal with, I think he's just really getting back to this, although he would argue that some steps have been taken already in terms of increasing the gas fuel standard for automobiles, for example, and also talking about this and even putting out a preliminary plan previously. I do think this is part of the effort. You know, there's a whole series of actions here with Iran, with Cuba, and now with climate change. These are the kinds of things that, you know, fit into this kind of hope and change that he talked about back as far back as 2007. So I think it's really a function of he's kind of freed up now to take on some of these issues that that he could probably not be as successful on, especially if he wanted to win re-election.
And this dovetails with a conference that's to be held in Paris in November. Tell us a little about that.
Right. This is really a follow-on to actually the Kyoto Protocol. And this goes back to really what was started in 2009 when President Obama was the first to visit one of these review conferences that are held yearly. And he went to Copenhagen and got this, at least as political agreement, to bring into the climate change discussion some of the developing countries. China and India and Brazil and South Africa were ones that signed on to this, at least as political statement, to do something about it. There have been subsequent review conferences. The Kyoto Protocol, or at least the first commitment under the Kyoto Protocol, ran out in 2012. It's now been extended until about 2020, but they also made a commitment in 2012 to try to get an enforceable treaty. And that's what you referenced there, Ben, in terms of by the end of 2015, the commitment is to try to get an enforceable treaty with the principal goal, and this goes to what President Obama said in that clip you had there, to reduce the kind of global warming that has occurred. The commitment is to a 2 degrees Celsius reduction. And so the plans that countries are putting together, are submitting, are aimed at that 2% Celsius reduction.
Jim McCormick of Iowa State University with us. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa talking initially on this Politics Wednesday about the revised clean power plan put forth by the president a couple of days ago, cutting greenhouse gas emissions from U.S. power stations by nearly a third within 15 years. As I mentioned at the outset, that there are opponents, and this is an election season. Let's listen to reaction to the Clean Power Plan from a couple of the candidates. Here are former Texas Governor Rick Perry, followed by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, reacting to President Obama on Fox News America's Newsroom program.
Our literal security is going to be put in jeopardy if this president puts these places or put these types of regulations in place. One of the first things that needs to happen is a president uses his executive authority to wipe out all this stuff that this president is doing to America's energy security. Wipe out with a pen. Bring the white out.
This is, again, the overregulation of the Obama administration. You know, Bill, last year they issued 81,000 pages of new federal regulation in 1 year. This is the greatest regulating administration in the history of the United States. And it is going to kill American businesses and jobs, as it has. That's why the president's taken a, you know, a victory lap for 2% GDP growth. This is the worst recovery from a recession since World War II.
Okay, there you have it. President Obama followed by two speaking in opposition to his clean power plan. Where do you stand? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio also on Facebook. Or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Tim Hagel, tell us more about those who oppose this plan and why.
Well, I think that part of it comes from what you heard in the second clip with Governor Christie talking about the overregulation. And as Jim was indicating, that President Obama at this point may be free, feel free to pursue some of these issues. And part of it has to do with his use of executive actions, which, of course, Republicans have been very unhappy with. But having done it a few times in various areas, and despite vocal opposition by Republicans, the Republicans weren't able to do much about it. And so now he basically says, look, this seems to be an avenue that I can pursue my policy goals without having to necessarily deal with those people in Congress, particularly now that Republicans control both chambers. And so this is something that, you know, he's basically willing to try despite the, again, vociferous opposition by Republicans. And yes, Republicans can say, oh, we're going to, as Governor Perry was saying in the first clip, we can, maybe the first Republican president can reverse those. But the problem is once they've been in place for a year or two, it becomes more difficult that people say, well, especially if nothing terrible has immediately happened, then people are maybe a little reluctant to have a president reverse field in that way.
Mm-hmm. You have a law degree, Tim Hagel, in addition to being a political scientist, and critics are arguing that this, as you referenced there, is it on any sort of legal, shaky legal ground? The administration says it's prepared to defend the regulations in court. How much of a question is there about the president's power in doing what he's wanting to do?
There's always that question, and it's often one that obviously legal scholars will disagree. Some will say, and obviously those in the president's administration will say, oh, yes, this is perfectly legal for the EPA to take on these additional responsibilities. On the other hand, opponents will say, no, it's not, and then you go to court and you let the judges decide. And so it's not going to prevent this. The big question may be whether opponents to the plan can find a judge that's willing to put in place an injunction to stop the regulations from going into effect, as opposed to they go into effect and then get challenged later.
Jim McCormick, do you see any question there about the president's authority in this area?
Well, this goes back to earlier court decisions in which the EPA claimed that they can regulate air pollution, and at least there are some precedents for taking this kind of action here. Previously, during the Bush administration, that's what I think that they're basing this on. That the courts have been favorable in terms of the government acting in terms of air pollution here. But I think Tim is right. What the opponents will probably do, and already maybe there's been a case filed here. I know that there was a report that the Attorney General of West Virginia, along with a series of others, attorneys general, were going to file a suit against these kind of regulations, and I'm sure that they will base it on whether there's an incorrect interpretation of the law of the Clean Air Act, which is the basis of this action by the president.
Talking about the revised Clean Power Plan put forward by the president a couple of days ago, and Jim McCormick with us of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa on this Politics Wednesday. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Also trying to get a feel for where our candidates are, GOP candidates specifically, but also Democratic candidates as well in terms of this clean power plan and energy policy. Let's listen to a montage of GOP candidates, what they've been saying about energy policy while campaigning here in Iowa. In the following audio, we're going to hear from Governor Chris Christie, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, and former Governor Rick Perry on energy policy. Let's have a listen to what they've been saying to us Iowans.
In New Jersey, the northeastern states have been part of something called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which was essentially a regional cap and trade program. When I became governor, I pulled out of that. I don't believe cap and trade makes sense. And what's happened in New Jersey, we're now the second largest solar producing state in the country because we've gotten to market-based solutions on helping solar thrive in our state. And only California produces more solar energy now than New Jersey. And also moving towards using nuclear, which we have. About 53% of our electricity in New Jersey comes from nuclear. And more use of natural gas. We have already exceeded our 2020 goals on carbon emissions without having cap and trade.
I support wind as part of an overall, all-the-above energy policy. To me, we can be competitive in the world economically. We can also shore up our national security issues if we are more dependent on the abundant supplies of energy we have here in America and in North America in particular. And that means we shouldn't be just single out one or the other, but we should say all the above. I want as many different energy policies, or not policies, energy options as possible out there. And if I was in a position as president, I'd advocate for that.
Wind is a part of that. But I think so is coal, so is nuclear, fossil fuel. The portfolio of American energy ought to be as broad and as sustainable as possible. But now one thing, let me just point out about oil and gas. We're in a very different place than we were even 8 years ago with oil and gas because of the new technology that exists. So that changes the marketplace constantly. But ultimately, it's making the marketplace better for the American consumer. That's a healthy thing.
And I will suggest to you, our future is inextricably intertwined to energy and North American energy. I know Jeb talked about our great friend, the Canadians, and right on he is about that. North American energy policy, I will suggest to you, which is so important to the future of this country. When I think about what is possible, when I think about the opportunities that we have in this country, Senator, I know that American energy is right at the heart of it. I know that. When you think about bringing North American energy, the Canadian sands, opening up the XL pipeline, being able to use domestic and Mexican energy in a North American energy strategy. We can drive down the cost of electricity.
Okay, a collection of GOP candidates there in reverse order. Rick Perry, before that, Mike Huckabee, Scott Walker, and Chris Christie, Governors Christie, Walker, and Huckabee were asked specifically about the renewable fuel standard and wind energy tax credits at the Ag Summit in March. Governor Perry's comments were from his speech at the Iowa GOP Lincoln Dinner in May. By the way, you can hear those speeches in their entirety. We've got a great website where you can listen to audio from all the 2016 candidates by going to iowapublicradio.org. You'll see a button that says Iowa Caucuses. You can explore all the issues and the candidates' views, their positions, by going to iowapublicradio.org. Tim Hagel, when we hear those four views there, do you see a great bit of difference in the energy policy between the Republican candidates, or pretty much all on the same page?
I think for the most part, the Republicans are on the same page. You are going to see variations, and one of the things that at least some of the candidates have been criticized for, particularly on the left, is but even sometimes on the right, is if they had taken different positions previously. Mm-hmm. I know some have talked about that with Walker and Bush and some others, where, okay, well, maybe they were in favor of something, but now they're not in favor of something, and camp and trade comes up. But some of those issues, it always depends on, well, what's the actual program and how does it develop? But sometimes you can sound like you're in favor of something. It sounds good, but when it's actually put into practice, it's a little bit different. In fact, we're even seeing that with the current program, where I saw one commentary by a liberal outlet that was actually complaining that they didn't think that the actual plan as it came out was as strong as the draft. But then I saw somebody else arguing the opposite. And so it's a matter of how it's actually going to be put into place before sometimes we see, even when we see what it is on paper, how it is in actual reality is sometimes different.
Meanwhile, the Democrats on the campaign trail in Iowa have been speaking out specifically about climate change. Former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley has held events focused specifically on green energy. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton include climate change in their stump speeches. Let's have a listen to some of their words.
Now, I know if some of you turn on the wrong channel and get the Fox by mistake, you will believe or hear that there is a debate about climate change. There is no debate. I sit on the Environmental Committee and the Energy Committee, and I can tell you that we have heard from scientists throughout our country and the world who say climate change is real, climate change is caused by carbon emissions and human activity, climate change is already causing devastating problems, and if we do not get our act together and transform our energy system, these problems will only become much more severe in terms of droughts and floods, extreme weather disturbances, rising sea levels. In my view, we have got to lead the world in transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy.
Now, ask these candidates about climate change, one of the defining threats of our time, and they'll say, I'm not a scientist. Well, then why don't they start listening to those who are scientists?
Hillary Clinton at a campaign rally in Des Moines in June. Bernie Sanders speaking at a Story County Democrats event in February. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, talking about energy policy, climate change. Tom is with us from Mount Vernon. Shortly before we go to break, Tom, as you hear all these views, some of them opposing views, so what are you thinking about?
Well, I'm glad to see that you're bringing in those who are actually focusing on the fundamental issue, which is climate change. And one thing that is interesting, the business community has already been stepping to the plate on this. They recognize what's going to happen. Divestiture in coal, divestiture in fossil fuels is a big factor right now. And they're also many more writers who are showing the actual cost of climate change to the business community, to insurance, the cost of droughts, the cost of fires, the cost of flooding. These are all issues that are the reason the climate policy was put into place. I applaud President Obama, but I really believe that he's not even going far enough. The G7 group said 70% reduction by 2050. And if that's going to occur, then the 20 to 30% that Obama's talking about is just a start. Thank you.
Okay. Tom from Mount Vernon, thank you very much for your view. 1-866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Let me share a couple of items on our social media. Joshua writing on our Facebook page, I am not sure why this is an issue, as according to another NPR newscast, the initiatives Obama wants are already being done by the energy companies. Republican candidates are very behind the times on this matter, writes Joshua, as they have been saying since the 1970s that if we have too much tied to clean energy, our grids would fail, but we are including more and more, and the grid hasn't collapsed. Mary in Keokuk County saying that the Republicans have not come up with alternatives, and we have deregulated to the point where anything goes. Can the guests address how we got to the point where we need a climate policy? Jim, what about that?
Well, I think one of the reasons is, first of all, there is a global kind of concern about this. As I was mentioning before, this has been on the agenda actually for about 2.5 decades, going back to about 1988 when the first sort of intergovernmental panel report put together on climate change. I mean, I think that's a major reason. The other, the same group, the same panel came out with a report just a couple of years ago, or actually in 2014, in which they talked about how much the global greenhouse gas emissions had increased from 2000 to 2014. So, you know, this has become a matter of more urgency. I think also there's a natural looking at all of the, you know, the kind of heat waves that we've had, the wildfires and so on. That has also been a stimulus to take a look at these kinds of items here. I just wanted to comment one thing.
We'll have to take a break, Jim, and we'll be back. Hold that thought, if you could. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Tim Hagel, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa, talking this hour about energy policy and President Obama's latest clean power plan. When we come back, we'll continue to talk about that and how it will figure into this election year. Will it be a big issue? Will it be a deciding issue for you when you come to support a candidate during the Iowa caucuses? Also, we'll talk about the debate to be happening tomorrow, the first GOP presidential candidate debate. When we come back, when I ask you, what question would you like to ask a presidential candidate in tomorrow's debate if you had the chance? 1-866-780-9100. We are back midstream in River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us on our talk show over the noon hour. Tomorrow on this program, I talk with Nathan Weiner. He's an Iowan fighting wildfires in the West we've been hearing about in the news. He'll explain the science of wildfires and some misconceptions we may hold about fire tomorrow on the program. Also, we'll hear about 12-year-old West Des Moines paperboy Johnny Gosch, who disappeared in 1982. This fits into a larger story about the politics of child safety in the late 20th century. Also tomorrow on this program. Today, it's Politics Day. Glad to have Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa with us, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, and you, if you'd like to join us. We've been talking about President Obama's clean power plan, the politics surrounding it. We want to move into talking about the presidential candidates as we are, what, six months or so away from the first in the nation test of these candidates, the Iowa caucuses. 1-866-780-9100. I want to get to you, Jim McCormick. I know you had a thought to share with us, but Matt on Facebook writing, no matter their other position on any other topic, if a candidate states that they do not feel climate change is happening or they do not think humans contribute to it, I cannot vote for that person. The science is too strong for there to be a debate. Matt, writing on our Facebook page from Boone, just to throw in here, NextGen Climate Action founder and California billionaire Tom Steyer. He's been in Iowa urging caucus goers to depress the candidates on the issue of climate change. And also in July, a group of Catholic bishops joined other religious leaders to urge caucus goers to embrace Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment and asked presidential candidates to take a stand on climate change. Now, Jim, I don't know if you had something to say related to that. You were going to make a point.
Yeah, I was just going to add one thing about from one of the callers. He talked about the lack of alternatives. I mean, part of it is, and I think we ought to make clear, is that certainly some on the Republican side, and maybe it's more widespread than that, do not really want government regulations of these sorts of things. I think they would take some incentives to do it on their own, because one of the callers noted that, in fact, some companies have moved ahead on their own because they see sort mm-hmm. of see the handwriting on the wall. And if they can do that with maybe some incentives, but without the involvement of government, that is an alternative they would consider. The other thing I think that ought to be mentioned is, and it was going back to what Governor Christie said, is that there are a number of regional PACs. You know, there's a West Coast states have PACs with Canada. Some of the East Coast states have PACs in terms of dealing with climate change already, and that's sort of lost sometimes in this discussion when we think it has to be done at the national level.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about how the president's Clean Power Plan is being received. We've talked about it at home, but internationally, Jim, what kind of impact did it make, that announcement, this move by the president?
Well, I think it's significant in the sense that, you know, given that the United States is the second leading polluter in the world, and it's the highest in terms of per capita income that in terms of pollution, that the president would make this kind of rather bold stand. I mean, even though some have said, well, a third is not much and it doesn't go very far, I was looking this morning at, you know, the reports from the other countries that have to submit also what their plans are. In fact, frankly, there's only 22 countries that have so far at least have submitted to the international agency dealing with the IPCC, that's the Climate Control Convention here. And the United States fits up very well in terms of having 32%. Now, the EU has 40% reduction that they've committed by 2030. Almost all of these countries have committed by 2030. Some have gone a little bit beyond that. Most of them have that as a target date, and so they're in the 25 to 40%. The EU, the European Union, is at the highest in terms of 40% of some of the major countries. The sad part of this is that there are some countries that are very important states in terms of pollution, and they haven't made a submission yet here. And of course, China did make a submission, but they made a submission that they would peak by 2030 in terms of their carbon emissions, and then also increase their non-fossil fuel energy development by 20%. So it's not really what we'd like to see, it seems to me, in terms of really getting a grasp on this. India is not there yet, and Brazil and South Africa have not submitted, which are other particularly developing countries that are polluters here.
Mm-hmm. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa with us on this Politics Day, talking about climate change, the politics surrounding it, also intertwined with that, energy policy. John is with us in Bettendorf. John, what's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
Right now, solar and wind can about 3 to 5 to 7, maybe 8% of what coal production plants do. All right. Depending upon how slowly you ramp down the coal companies, how many decades is it going to take solar and wind to get up to the production that coal or that sun and wind are producing right now? How many decades is that going to take?
That's a very good question, John. I don't know if we have the expertise at the table for this hour to answer that, Jim.
I'll leave that to Tim.
Oh, yeah, great. Okay, maybe that's for another show when we do have energy experts. Or Tim, can you say something?
I can't really, of course, answer that particular question. But what the caller is getting at is the idea that right now we don't have the capability to shut down the coal companies and the use of coal as a fuel because of, as a sort of a, I don't know how you want to measure the units, but it's coal and fossil fuels are much more efficient in terms of delivering the energy we need despite the downside to doing so. And so we have to basically keep in mind that either we're going to have to drastically reduce our energy consumption, which is pretty unlikely as that's probably increasing, or we're going to have to find some way to really ramp up more than we have the use of these alternative fuels, whether it's solar, wind, or anything else.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit from the topic we've been addressing to the presidential candidates. The GOP forum held on Monday and the first GOP debate tomorrow. Let's talk about that GOP forum Monday, the first presidential candidate forum held. It was in Manchester, New Hampshire. 14 Republican presidential candidates. And Donald Trump skipped that event, saying it was not worth his time. Tim, you watched it. What stood out for you?
Well, what was, I think, important about that event was, first, the number of people that were there, 14 of the 17 candidates, even though Trump wasn't there and a couple of others. But it was very fast. And I saw when I was watching on Twitter that many people described it as speed dating, that basically each candidate came out and had to maybe 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes to answer some questions, and they had two rounds of that. So they had a very strict two-hour time limit because of television constraints. But even so, and even though those of us who have seen other forums of this sort before, we weren't learning anything particularly new. Nobody had any major faux pas. A couple of people stumbled a little bit in terms of getting their points out as quickly as was necessary. But for the most part, it was stuff that those of us, again, who had seen these forums had seen before. The difference is that now with the increased interest and all of the attention given to the debate that's happening tomorrow, more people were probably tuning in, particularly in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, which media outlets were sponsoring this forum, more people were now seeing these candidates for the first time. So in that sense, it was an introduction and basically a first impression that a lot of them were able to make.
And for these 14 Republican presidential candidates, a chance to practice, perhaps those that will be, well, they will be in one form or another participating tomorrow on the Fox News 2 events. The lineup for the first GOP presidential debate tomorrow is now set. Donald Trump, Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Mike Huckabee, Ben Carson, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Chris Christie, and John Kasich making that cut. Fox said there would only be 10 based on polling. It's a two-hour debate from Cleveland. 8 o'clock, I think, is the start time for us Central on Fox News. It will feature the top 10 candidates. And then there's another forum, 4 o'clock our time, I believe, to be aired on Fox, feature the other 7 GOP candidates who are running. We want to ask you listeners, what question would you like to pose the presidential candidates if you were able to do that for tomorrow's debate? River to river at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can put that answer on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. So I guess the big question, what will Donald Trump do in this first 2016 Republican debate? Tim Hagel, your thoughts?
Well, that is the big question, and I know I've talked to some folks about this, and that's, they say, well, what – the question I sometimes ask is, well, what's the strategy for the various people that are going to be on the stage in the main debate? And a lot of it really has to do with what Donald Trump is going to do. How is he going to come across? Mm-hmm. If he's going to come across in ways that we've seen that are fairly aggressive in his comments, then the rest of the candidates have to approach that slightly differently. But they still should probably try to take the high road, it's a little bit early to start throwing elbows in the way that we might see in some later debates. On the other hand, if Trump is less aggressive, tries to become more statesmanlike, they can stick to the message, not worry about the messengers kind of a thing. But there's a danger for Trump if he doesn't come across as the way he has already, which is as Trump. That's the thing that has attracted so many supporters to him. And if all of a sudden he pulls it back for an event like this, then they may be disappointed in him. So he's got a difficult decision as to how to walk that fine line, too.
Yeah, McCormick, well, we see the Donald Trump as we know him, as brazen as we know him, or will he step back from that, temper his rhetoric to be more statesmanlike, if you want to put it that way, more presidential, if you would like, more traditionally presidential, perhaps I should say it that way.
Yeah, I think that he will probably try to be restrained a bit. I mean, he's on the top of the polls right now, you know, and if people are really turning in to see him from around the country, they will maybe say, well, maybe, you know, some of the press that he's gotten about being brazen and sort of very outspoken is sort of overstated. So one of the tactics, and obviously it's an unknown here, would be for him to show that he is no real pariah, that he can be restrained, be statesmanlike, and so on. That's sort of my take on how he might change his approach a bit here in this debate.
Tim touched on this, but Jim, your thoughts on how, in if this can be called a debate with 10 people, 14 in the forum we had before, how do you set yourself apart effectively from 9 other candidates on the stage in this sort of debate?
I think the only way you can really do it is to focus on the message that you want to use that has become sort of your mantra. I mean, somebody like Scott Walker, who talks about not only can he fight, but he can fight and win, and, you know, and so you get that, you want to get that mantra that you have been using on the campaign stump, you know, in the minds of the public as well. So I think that's the only way to do it. I think overall it's very difficult with such a large group to make very much inroads, mm-hmm. except, again, for introducing yourself to the public at large here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When we think back about previous debates, standout comments, Lloyd Benson, you're no Jack Kennedy,
right.
Or where's the beef? I think Ronald Reagan facing
Mondale. With
that's
the age question.
Yes, exactly. So zingers at your opponents, does that score you points? Or is it the well-thought-out, concise answers tied to issues?
You know, it's always a combination of things. And there were a couple of examples you mentioned, the Lloyd Benson comment to Dan Quayle about saying, you know, I know Jack Kennedy, you know Jack Kennedy. Well, that was an instance where, because Quayle had been using that line prior to the debate, it was a good setup. And as soon as that talking point got repeated by Quayle, then Benson was able to come back very quickly with it. So sometimes you can be ready for that kind of thing, although keep in mind that was also when we got down to the general election debates. And as debates like this in the primary process, and especially a very early debate like this, the first one, that really what I think candidates have to do are basically 3 things. That basically avoid gaffes of one sort or another, misstatements or something along those lines, no oops moment. Try to show that they're likable and try to demonstrate some form of leadership. Beyond that, they really, and especially when you've got 10 people on the stage, beyond that, it's going to be very difficult to find some standout moment. Now, they could happen, and a quick-witted person can basically use that to his or her advantage. But for the most part, with this many on the stage, it's basically you make a good first impression, and where they're going to have to do their really serious campaign work is in other venues.
Let's talk briefly before the hour ends about the international news, related to the Iran nuclear deal. President Obama, we heard in the top of the hour, making a speech today at American University in Washington, explaining, defending the international agreement reached last month between 6 world powers and Iran. It's a deal that would lift some sanctions in exchange for restrictions on Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon. The president has plenty of critics, have promised to use this month-long congressional recess to pressure lawmakers to oppose the accord. Now, Jim, help us out here understanding the president's goal is simply to prevent the 2/3 majority in the Senate needed to block this nuclear deal, which would be to block the lifting of sanctions that go along with it. Does it look like the president has enough support in Congress?
Oh, I think that there's probably no doubt that he can, prevent a veto override. I think, obviously, he'd like to get win on the first round. I don't think, as I was thinking about looking at the combination of numbers, that is really possible to get a majority and on the first vote. I think he will have to use his veto power, but I would be absolutely stunned if he doesn't have sufficient votes in the Senate. I mean, prevent a veto override by the Congress. I think it's probably a little more dicey in the House, but in the Senate, he can certainly pick up enough party loyalty votes, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. That's one bit of analysis I saw was that he's trying now to get at least one Republican vote in the Senate to come over. So it's not, a purely partisan issue. Is it a purely partisan issue up to this point, or Jim?
I would judge it. I would find it hard for him to win any Republicans on this. So I do think it comes down to a partisan vote. And I think that's why he's going to be able to hold a sufficient number to prevent a veto override here. The problem is that if it's fairly lopsided on the first vote, and if there are that many Democrats on the first vote that's held, that might sort of have a contagion effect in terms of a subsequent override here. So I think that's why he's trying to keep down the numbers. And as you say, if he could somehow steal a Republican vote to support the agreement, that would give him a little bit more leverage, even if he has to use the veto pen.
Now, as we wind down President Obama's second term, a clear foreign policy vision in this would be a big part of his legacy. We've had talked about this in program many times. Years of crisis management in places like Syria, Iraq, Egypt, Libya, and Ukraine. So would this be if not the crowning achievement in foreign policy for the Obama administration?
I do think it would be, right at the top there. I think opening to Cuba is going to be significant too, in sort of the terms of the history books as well. I mean, the Iran agreement, in terms of how it actually plays out. We had the Clinton administration signed an agreement with North Korea in 1994, and that sort of unraveled within about 5 or 6 years. So I think the Cuban opening to Cuba may well be more significant than Iran, because we don't know what the outcome down the road is with regard to the Iran agreement.
Mm-hmm. And finally, the controversy and plenty of politics surrounding a series of secretly recorded videos from anti-abortion rights activists capturing Planned Parenthood medical staff discussing the procurement of organs from aborted fetuses. Republican and Senate Judiciary Chair Chuck Grassley of Iowa, of course, said yesterday he has opened an inquiry into Planned Parenthood's quote, facilitation of activities described in the videos. House Judiciary Committee announcing last month that it would investigate this organization as well. This past Monday, a bill that would have blocked all federal funding for Planned Parenthood failed in the Senate. Tim Hagel, how do you see this battle developing on Capitol Hill?
Well, as you indicated, that the first attempt to get something through in the Senate failed, filibustered by the Democrats, basically. But I suspect that this is not going to be an issue that goes away, particularly if more videos come forward. And it's, as one writer was suggesting, it may be the kind of issue that really galvanizes or really fires up the people that, in this case, are opposed to this type of procedure, what's going on here, or just more generally abortion or planned Parenthood, or however you want to phrase it. Now, if they can manage to focus in on what's specifically going on in those videos and not get into the broader abortion issue, or as some of the Democrats, Hillary Clinton in particular, want to talk about it in terms of women's health, and that's how they've characterized it, saying, oh, well, if you defund Planned Parenthood, you're hurting, you know, mm-hmm. women's access to various health services and so forth, then it muddies the waters and the issue a little bit, and it becomes harder for those that would like to defund Planned Parenthood to actually do so. And it didn't help when Jeb Bush happened to make that essentially a misstatement on how he characterized it, because he was talking about wanting to defund Planned Parenthood,
right,
but phrased it in
Hillary
a way,
Clinton jumped on his
and
comment.
Hillary Clinton jumped right on
and
it.
He had to admit that his campaign at least admitted that he misspoke. Jim McCormick, not much time, but your view on this issue?
Well, I think it's going to be an issue right throughout the campaign. I can envision there will be some campaign ads by Republicans here using snippets of those videos that have been released. I think it'll be interesting to see how it plays out with some of the how it does help some of the social conservative Republican candidates. You know, got such a large field. Would this be an issue that could help one of those candidates sort of come up distinguish him or herself on this particular issue?
Jim McCormick, we have to say goodbye. Tim Hagel, thank you also for being with us. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa. Jim and Tim, they rhyme, and it's been a pleasure being with both of you.
Thank you.
It's great to be with you.
River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.